When we think of the Star Spangled Banner today, we think of it as this kind of singular, I don't know, masterpiece might be too strong, but it's but sort of singular work, right? That it's more famous. It's got the official sanction of being the national anthem of the United States. And so we don't really – we've forgotten a lot about the Star Spangled Banner. And so that's maybe what my research is primarily about, is recovering this lost history
right.
of the anthem. And one of the things you come to realize, and maybe the most surprising thing for me in my research, is how many different sets of words were sung to the melody we now know as the Star Spangled Banner.
Right.
So what Francis Scott Key did in the Chesapeake Bay when he, you know, saw the flag and responded to this unexpected U.S. victory was really participate in a cultural discourse. He joined a conversation that was very common in the night, really throughout the 19th century, of individuals reacting to current events, sort of celebrating mm-hmm. an important moment, arguing for a particular political candidate, arguing for a particular philosophy, or, you know, marking some dramatic happening, such as the victory at the Battle of Baltimore, by writing a set of words to fit a well-known melody
right.
that then would be printed in the words would be printed in the newspaper with the instructions, you know, sung to the tune of, in Francis
right.
Scott Key's case, Anacreon, you know, referring to Anacreon in Heaven, which is the British or London-based musicians club that had this anthem called To Anacreon in Heaven. In the 19th century, I mean, it's sort of the pre-recorded days. We don't have microphones. We don't have amplifiers. We don't have record players.
Right.
You know, so Edison's cylinder and recording wouldn't be invented until 1877. And so we're sort of in this pre-recorded age. So if you're going to hear music, if you're going to be part of music, you're making it yourself or it's being performed live right by you. So the relationship that I think individuals had to music was much more sort of hands-on and participatory. So we may not, you know, think that we're great singers, but that's not such an important thing. Just to be a citizen in 1814 meant that you sang. You sang in church. You probably went to church. You probably had some voice training in church, you know, rather than sort of music being part of the public schools, which were just started getting going in those decades, particularly in Boston. We're sort of in this age where the church is the main music education vehicle. And so everybody's singing. You know, maybe not well, but they're singing, right? And so people had this repertory of maybe 100 tunes that they just knew off the top of their head. They could sing at any time. And we probably have a dozen now. Happy Birthday, Take Me Out to the Ball Game.
Yep.
You know, Row, Row, Row Your Boat. You know, a few things that all of us
Classics.
Could sing. And if someone handed you a set of lyrics and said, sing to the tune of Row, Row, Row Your Boat, you know, you could do it. So the same thing was happening as part of what was called the broadside ballad tradition in the 19th century. And this was very common. So, you know, an issue of a newspaper might have one or two sets of lyrics in it that were responding to various things. There'd be a little poet's corner. And some of those were just poems, and some of them were actually lyrics to songs. And this, I think, if there's one misunderstanding about Key's anthem, is that most people think that he wrote a poem that mm-hmm. someone else set to music. But he really wrote a lyric with this melody called To Anacreon in Heaven in his mind. And then he expected that his audience, reading the words off the page and seeing the indication, you know, sung to the tune Anacreon Heaven, would immediately know how to perform the words, just like we would if it was to the tune of Happy Birthday or Take Me Out to the Ball Game. So that's was just sort of part of public life at this time, part of the kind of public discourse, part of the way ideas were shared. It's often said that broadside ballads were about, you know, sort of getting the news in a pre-literate day. So, you know, again, we don't have public schools, so not everybody reads. So newspapers won't work for everybody, right?
Right.
So some people are going to have to get their news by word of mouth. And so the town crier in the center of the city square could sing the news. I don't think actually that's that plausible in terms of a way which most people got their information, right? The facts you could get from someone just by asking a question, right? So if you wanted to know who won the Battle of Baltimore, you would say, "Hey, who won?" Right? You wouldn't say, "Hey, who won?" And someone would say, "Oh, wait, let me sing you a song. I just heard this one. Just hold on, I've got to warm up my voice, and
yeah.
then I'll sing." No, they would just say, "Hey, we won." So instead, I think what really happened by people taking words and then marrying them to melody is that it wasn't so much they were telling you the facts, but they were telling you the feelings of what it meant that these things had happened, right? So Francis Scott Key's song doesn't really inform people that the United States repulsed the British attack. Rather, it emphasizes the sense of relief, the sense of excitement, the sort of growing confidence of the nation around this event, right? Because remember, it starts with this question, you know, say, does that Star-Spangled Banner yet wave over the land of the free and the home of the brave? Question mark.
Right.
Right. So that's the sort of opening salvo is, are we going to survive as a country? And the music and the melody tells you absolutely, right? Because you're going to sing this huge melody with these, you know, interval of a 12th, this really wide,
right,
athletic, fast initially tune, you know, oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light, right? Which is sort of rollicking celebration tune.
Right.
Right. So that's what's being communicated is the feeling of the news, not so much the facts. Because again, you know, we don't have photographs of them. We don't have, you can't go on YouTube and see the latest highlight reel.
Right.
Right. Things happening may feel very far away. So by having the broadside tradition, it helps us feel what it means. It helps us get a sense of what it was like to be there. And
right.
So Francis Scott Key is a kind of observer who's sharing an emotional snapshot. And the way to convey that emotion over distance is through music. So that's really what happens. So it turns out that this melody, Anacreon in Heaven, or the Anacreontic Song, which starts in London as the anthem of this musicians' club, is wildly popular and
sure.
is used for literally at least 100 different texts that I've found
oh, wow.
in the 19th century. So Francis Scott Key is just a small little part of this much bigger tradition. And Anacreon, the melody, was only one of many, many melodies that was being used. So Yankee Doodle is one that we remember today.
Sure.
But there were others that we've completely forgotten, like Heart of Oak. You know, so there's lots of these melodies that are in the public sphere that are used to sort of give life to these words that respond to, you know, day-to-day events.
I believe that the abolitionist movement used this tune. Do you have any insight onto the lyrics that they were writing?
Certainly, after Francis Scott Key writes the Star-Spangled Banner, it becomes immediately popular. Part of it is it's riding this wave of enthusiasm because of, you know, we'd had the burning of Washington a month before. People were feeling pretty bummed out about the
sure,
prospects
yeah.
of the country. Then we have this miraculous victory at Baltimore, and the tide sort of turns on the War of 1812. You know, it ends up just the next year in 1815 with the Battle of New Orleans and Andrew Jackson defeating the British sort of soundly. There's a peace treaty signed. And so there's this wave of patriotic sentiment that sort of really elevates Key's song to popularity. So that's part of the reason it survives is that it gets a little bit of extra boost by the victory in the war as a whole. Another thing that's important about Key's text, or his lyric that's sort of different from most of these lyrics, is that his is pretty abstract. Like, he doesn't mention Fort McHenry. He doesn't
right.
mention the Battle of Baltimore. He doesn't really, you know, mention the British by name. You know, everything's sort of symbolic. And so that allows his text to sort of stand up over time.
Transcend,
right, the sort of peculiarities of that historical moment and those details and then represent the country more broadly. So that certainly helps his song. But one of the things that happens as a result is that the melody to Anacreon gets more and more tightly associated with the United States as a nation.
Right.
Right, so this tune, which had originally been British, now is very much an American tune. And so if you want to, again, put an idea into the public sphere about maybe a different direction that the country should take, or if you want to comment on something about, you know, the way we're functioning as Americans, you might use that tune, you know, to sort of give voice to protest, for example.
Right.
So as early as 1826, we see a 4th of July song, which is really, you know, sort of trading on the patriotism that Francis Scott Key helps propel. And 1826, of course, is the 50th anniversary of the United States, you know, sort of Declaration of Independence being 1776. And so we see that sort of, again, further deepening. And then we get into the 1840s, which is pretty interesting, with some common uses of broadside ballads. One would be for political campaign songs. So William Henry Harrison has a song called Harrison and Liberty from 1840, which is one of his campaign songs. In fact, he has like seven different campaign songs all sung to the tune of the Star-Spangled Banner.
Oh,
and then we get
prolific.
Into some really interesting texts in 1843 and 44, which sort of are connected to the sort of fight for women's rights and also for the abolition of slavery. So one of the big things that was a women's rights issue in the 19th century was temperance, was sort of alcoholism, right? So if men are sort of the public, if we want to say diplomat of the family, right? Women are largely in the domestic sphere. So men are in the public sphere. They're going to go out and earn a living. If within your family, if the man is disabled by the disease of alcoholism, then the family is largely destroyed.
Right.
So the issue of alcohol abuse, of temperance, which was sort of the name for abstinence of alcohol, was a women's rights issue, was a family public health issue. In 1843, in the what was called the Cold Water Magazine, because temperance advocates wanted you to just drink cold water rather than beer and alcohol, had a parody of the Star-Spangled Banner called Oh, Who Has Not Seen? And it was really about this husband who was in the gutter and neglected his wife.
Oh.
And so the text is, Oh, who has not seen by the dawn's early light some poor bloated drunkard to his home weekly reeling, with blear eyes and red nose most revolting to sight, yet still in his breast not a throb of shame feeling. So you can – it's actually a very moving song, even though initially the text sounds pretty silly. But it really – if you put yourself in the emotional position of this poor woman who's sort of abandoned and can't – doesn't have the money to take care of her children because her husband is afflicted with alcoholism, it's pretty powerful. But you can hear how the text actually is sort of quoting Key's original. So, you know, who is not seen by the dawn's early light? So that dawn's early light idea is making a direct connection between this text and then Francis Scott Key's, you know, future anthem. But already we're seeing this as a way to comment on sort of what's good and bad in America.
Right.
So here we have this public health crisis, right, this, of alcoholism stealing this father from this family, and we've got to do something about it. And it's a national crisis. It's not just a personal crisis. And so giving voice through Key's song,
right,
and a parody of Key's song does that. Maybe the most powerful text that I've come across, amazingly enough, was published right here in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
That's
in
wonderful.
An abolitionist newspaper in 1844 called The Signal of Liberty. And the Ann Arbor District Library has the complete run of The Signal of Liberty. So this is one place where my research has really taken root at home. But this lyric was published as a new version of the national anthem, and it actually was picked up by Henry Lloyd Garrison's The Liberator and sort of goes national, but it starts here in Michigan. And this text starts off, Oh, say, do you hear at the dawn's early light the shrieks of those bondmen whose blood is now streaming from the merciless lash, while our banner in sight with its stars mocking freedom is so fitfully gleaming? Do you see the backs bare? Do you mark every score of the whip of the driver, trace channels of gore, and say, doth our star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave? So that question mark there, you know, sort of asking the question, is this truly a free nation if a whole part of humanity within our borders is, you know, chained in bondage? It does not have the freedom of movement and person and the respect of being treated as a soulful human being rather than a thing to be bought and sold. So this is really one of the most incredible texts, I think, that I've come across. It's a parody of the Star-Spangled Banner and uses the growing nationalist sentiment and sort of growing popularity of Key's song to comment on national identity.
And so these were able to spread, and these messages and these commentaries, because it was a familiar tune, very popular song, and so that helped them to have a broader audience?
Right. So when this tune was published in Ann Arbor and the Signal Liberty was then, you know, other editors of newspapers subscribed to newspapers in the region, and they would take, you know, good articles or good little items, and then they would repeat and reprint them. I mean, I guess it's sort of like the way we post things to Facebook now, tweet things out. There was a kind of viral mechanism that pushed these lyrics from paper to paper. And so they would be picked up and then spread into wider geographies and sort of influence other groups. And because everybody knew the tune was, you know, an easy thing sort of to bring the country together around this conversation about what it really meant to be American. The what I've really found is that Francis Scott Key in some ways was jumping into the same moment. I mean, the way I've told the story so far makes it sound like it started with him. But in fact, the tune, as I said, started in London. Mm-hmm. The Anacreontic Society was something that was, you know, its meetings were public news. They were in the London Times. They would talk about the, you know, popular singer from the London theater, sort of like a Broadway star now, you know, who would be singing the Anacreontic song at their meetings, and that
exciting.
That performance could be reviewed. They could like it or not like it, depending on how it went that evening. So this was considered – was popular enough that it was part of the newspaper discourse in the 1760s and 70s. That ends up then being – since they have these, you know, professional singers on the theater stage – as the singers for the club, they end up performing the song as part of other shows, and it's sort of becomes part of this public discourse, these melodies and tunes that everybody knows. And immediately we start getting parodies, a couple of which are drinking songs.
So, oh.
so the reputation that the Star Spangled Banner has about being based on a drinking song really comes from the initial sheet music of the Anacreontic song, which isn't really a drinking song.
Right.
It confuses people because it says on the sheet music, it says, as sung at the Crown and Anchor Tavern. Right. We make it sound like a drinking song, but the Crown and Anchor Tavern is sort of like, you know, the Marriott Hotel
in London.
The meeting
place,
yeah,
right.
It's like, it's like one of the big, you know, respectable places. It's a restaurant. It's not a pub.
A pub.
They have a big ballroom and have symphony concerts as part of their meetings, right? So it's
not
a different scale
same.
than you know, going down for a pint at the local brew pub. But anyway, it does get used in the popular sphere for these drinking songs. One called The New Bebo is one of them, and then one called Jack Oakum and the Suds. And the interesting thing about that text is that it refers to basically this sailor for the British Navy who drinks himself to death.
Oh.
And then he goes down into the, you know, into the Greek sort of mythological underworld and ends up sort of deciding that, you know, if this is what death's all about, he doesn't really want any part of it.
Oh.
He'd rather go and have another pint of beer. And sort of he's kicked out of the underworld to go back. But this is the first time that the text is associated with something sort of militaristic or patriotic, if you will.
Right.
And that ends up, for whatever reason, becoming the main thread of the story of this melody. So the melody initially gets used in the United States. One of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, actually Francis Hopkinson, writes a parody that's sort of in this drinking song vein. But in public discourse, it gets used for songs celebrating or criticizing the French Revolution.
Oh.
And of course, the French were our allies against the British
right.
in the Revolutionary War, in our Declaration of Independence. When they have a revolution,
yes.
many people in the United States support them, right? And so there are these songs for the glorious 14th of July or Freedom Triumphant, which are parodies using the same melody that we're talking about, the Anacreon melody, but celebrating the French Revolution. And then interestingly, there's a reaction to that, another song called To Genet in New York, right? So To Anacreon in Heaven. You can see how, again, the words and the phrases get repeated
right.
and rehearsed. So you know all these songs are connected. They're all part of the same family. But Ambassador Genet was the French ambassador to the United States, and he actually came to the United States and was trying to raise an army to go back and help fight the French Revolution. The U.S. government, George Washington, was trying to remain neutral because, of course,
okay.
English – we were important – you know, commercial trading partners with both France and England.
Right.
We tried to sort of do the Swiss thing and stay right in the middle. It didn't work out. But anyway, there's this parody To Genet in New York, which basically is an anti-French Revolution song. But you can see that this melody gets wrapped up in political discourse in the young nation
right.
of the United States. Another pivot point is 1798. In 1798, there's two American parodies that are written. One celebrates George Washington's birthday. It's just before his death. And then the other is a song in support of the second president, John Adams, right, who was caught, again, in this tension between France and England and the United States. One of the things this led to is what's called the quasi-war with France. And so there was all this worry about sedition and disloyalty in the United States. And so that's when the Alien and Sedition Acts were passed
right.
under the Adams administration. Very controversial sort of, sort of bracketed off some really fundamental rights that we see now as today in our Bill of Rights. And so to support Adams, this song Adams and Liberty was done that, again, was just written to this exact same tune of the Star-Spangled Banner. And this is probably the most popular tune, you know, in early America that probably spread the association between dun 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 and American political life.
Right.
John Adams was a Federalist Party member, so, you know, we weren't supposed to have political parties according to the Constitution, but we immediately do. And one of them is the Federalist Party, and Adams is the head of the Federalist Party. And another member of the Federalist Party is a guy named Francis Scott Key. So it's very possible that he heard the song or sang the song in support of John Adams, or that it would have been part of his social circle. So what happens just a couple years later in 1805 is that Francis Scott Key, who's a young lawyer in Washington, D.C., trying to sort of make an impression, is invited to a party to celebrate sort of the first two military heroes of the young nation, who are Stephen Decatur Jr. and Charles Stewart, who were heroes, naval heroes in the Tripolitan War of the Barbary pirates in North Africa. And they had there had been a ship, the USS Philadelphia, that had run aground and been captured by the enemy. And they actually led this sort of daring raid. And they were going to try to free the ship, and they couldn't, but they set the ship on fire to at least destroy it so that the enemy couldn't use it as a gun battery, which they had been. So they were brought back to Washington. They were huge heroes. And Francis Scott Key writes a song in their honor. Guess what melody he uses, right? He uses this melody that had been celebrated Adams, that had celebrated Thomas Jefferson had a campaign song using the same melody. So he writes a song called When the Warrior Returns that he himself sings at this dinner party in honor of Decatur and Stewart. And the tune goes like this: When the warrior returns from the battle afar to the home and a country he nobly defended, oh, warm be the welcome to gladden his ears, and loud be the joy that his perils are ended. So same tune. And this is one of the reasons that we know that 9 years later, when Key is in Baltimore Harbor, that he knows this tune, right?
Oh,
he's used it before for the same theme. Right, to celebrate American military heroes. Interestingly, again, he doesn't mention Decatur's name. He doesn't mention Stewart's name. He doesn't mention the Tripolitan War. There's nothing specific in here. It's about when the warrior returns from the battle afar.
Right.
It's not when Stephen Decatur returns from the Tripolitan War, right? Which would, again, make it more specific, sort of less abstract, less able to sort of appeal to sort of broader ideals of patriotism. So I think this is his tendency. So when he does, it's in keeping with what he does
right.
9 years later. But there's a great line in here when he talks about the flags of the enemy and the flags of America. And he uses the phrase, by the light of the star-spangled flag of our nation. So that initial turn to the Star-Spangled Banner that he would do 9 years later is actually prefigured by the text here when he calls it the Star-Spangled Flag. The word spangled today, I mean, we don't use it that much. We don't talk about the star-spangled light of your eyes or whatever. But at this point, spangled is really more of just an adjective, right?
Common.
Yeah, but it's because I think of Francis Scott Key's use of it that we start to associate with the flag, and the flag and the song are very intimately intertwined because of that particular language.
Absolutely.
So that's really how it goes. And then, you know, when Francis Scott Key's song becomes hugely popular right after the end of the War of 1812, that just propels the same story. But really, Key is jumping on a train that's already moving.
Right.
He's taking a melody that people are already associating with American heroism, with sort of military success and patriotism, and then he's adding his own comment to that conversation. Today, we only hear that one voice, right? Because Francis Scott Key's Star-Spangled Banner is the only song that has survived from this very common broadside practice. But in Key's day, what he was doing was just sort of part of a tradition, was part of a kind of public discourse.